Hello, and welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. My name is David Voiles, and with me this week is Richard Weeks. Total Monkery is an independent game studio and family business with a healthy fixation on mockery, puns, and primates. Created in 2012 by game development veteran Richard Weeks, Total Monkery aims not only to produce high-quality products, but also foster new talents, collaborate with passionate indies, and contribute value to the industry that we love. Richard, thank you for joining me this week.
Hi, Dave. No problem.
Hi, so we've had several UK developers on board recently. So when I first started off this podcast, it was largely folks in the Seattle area, and the last couple of months it's been the UK. So you guys have quite the development scene going on over there, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. I mean, I don't suppose everybody knows, but yeah, I mean, there's a big sort of homebrew, as in, you know, at-home computer programming thing that's been going on here since the early 80s. So yeah, there's quite a lot of development houses around Britain.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I subscribe to Retro Gamer Magazine, which I get through digital waves every month. And it is a completely different world over there in that it really just covers old games in the 80s, 90s. But it was amazing to see how much different the game development scene was in the UK in the 80s and 90s from what it was over here. I mean, you guys are using things like FM Towns Marty, which just never existed in America.
Yeah, well, I suppose in the 80s, I remember, you know, a lot of people in America, because I used to work in America, would have like NESs, etc. I don't know anybody who had a NES. We all had computers, and I'd say a good, you know, up to 50% of us are actually programming on them as well. So we'd write our own little games, but as well as that, you know, we were playing a lot of games off cassette and things like that, rather than playing the consoles.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that dichotomy there and how different the two markets were. And then when you take into consideration Japan, you know, they had a number of consoles and especially a large number of software that we never got on the Western side.
Yeah.
So you said
with the FM Towns Marty, I mean, I never actually had one personally, but I know people that did have them, and you know, we were actually working on games for them over here. But I know when I worked in the States, nobody even heard of them.
Okay, so you're from the UK, but then you were working in the States and then came back?
Yeah, I got my first break in games after I left college, where I got a job at Psygnosis, and then I worked there in a couple of other English places for about 5-6 years before deciding to dip my toe abroad and went to the States and sort of ended up at LucasArts for a couple of years.
Well, I mean, either way, not a bad place to start off your career. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with Psygnosis, they had a ton of games in the 80s. The 90s were just massive, especially with Sony. The first game I played was Microcosm on Sega CD, and then Lemmings.
Yeah. I worked on the CD32 version of Microcosm, and that was my first job.
So what is CD32 exactly?
CD32 was a console Amiga. So you had Amigas, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, so they weren't really big in the States, though.
No. So it was basically a stripped-down Amiga 1200 with a CD drive, which we got very, very early at Psygnosis because we were, you know, really into, you know, the cutting-edge technology at the time.
Yeah.
And that was my first job, basically working on one of those. I mean, it was just, when we had it was a circuit board basically hammered into a cardboard box with a power pack on the side. But, I mean, that's what dev kits were like back then.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And if other developers ever get a chance to go to GDC, they often have a traveling museum that goes along with it. And this time they had like older NES hardware dev kits, old Genesis ones. And it's amazing to see what people had to work with 20 years ago, 25 years ago, as opposed to what we have now, which looks, you know, often just like a normal retail box unit.
Yeah, I mean, the CD32 one was very, very basic. Then we got some real kits. But, I mean, there was no debugging environment. I mean, basically you made your code, you assembled it, you copied it onto a floppy, you walked over to the development machine, you put it in the drive, and then you hoped it worked.
I mean, there was no way.
There was no feedback whatsoever. I mean, it was all 100% assembly as well. So it wasn't for the faint at heart, but it was really good fun.
Holy cow. Wow, that really makes me appreciate the tools I have now. I shouldn't really be complaining, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I work in Unity a lot now, and you sort of, you know, the fact that it doesn't work exactly as you want it to, I can live with that because I remember how much worse it can actually be.
Yeah, exactly. And, the ability to debug, you know, from your console now makes it much easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were at Psygnosis, and then you later on went to LucasArts.
Yep.
I've got to ask about that. You know, what was that like?
Bit daunting.
I bet.
I worked at another place in America first and got laid off, and then luckily LucasArts was across the road, so a few of us went over there. It was in the Ode studio in Marin, so
beautiful area over there.
Yeah, oh, it's fantastic. But it's basically this straight-looking office building. They didn't advertise the fact they were there.
Yeah.
Because what would have happened is all the fanboys would have come around and just hung around outside. Because, of course, we had loads of stuff from the films, etc. But there were about 300 of us in there.
Holy cow.
Game teams tended to be between 20 and 60. So I worked on a couple of games there. And, yeah, it was a hell of a lot of fun because George Lucas does like to treat his people well. So there were parties going on, and you could go to Skywalker Ranch, which is always fun. So yeah, really, really enjoyed working there. But I was laid off in one of the big culls when they were all sort of changing around in the early 2000s.
Yeah. You know, once adventure games really started to take a turn for the south, I think that's what happened with a number of studios.
Yeah, funnily enough, the guys, or at least one of the guys that ended up forming Telltale, was in an office about three doors down from me. He was working on Sam & Max. and then, of course, they left and then did Sam & Max for Telltale. So, yeah, I remember those days.
Oh, man. And it's funny because now it's kind of like the industry comes full circle, because I had this conversation with someone else this morning where the number of venture games has grown exponentially, especially with the advent of Kickstarter.
I think LucasArts were wrong. And we all believe that LucasArts were wrong at that point. It was just at that point, maybe, you know, adventure games weren't seen as, you know, a good investment for the company. But it was very, very short term because, you know, adventure games were really back on the scene by, 2005, really. And it was 2002 when they canned the game. Because, I mean, we were doing a remake of Full Throttle as well. Well, not a remake, a sequel. And that went as well. And there were plans to do some of the other classic adventure games as well, but you know, it just all fell by the wayside when they decided they wanted more adventure games.
Yeah, I mean, in the last month alone, I've gone through, you know, Broken Sword, they have Wolf Among Us, the new Tex Murphy game came out, the last game in Blackwell Deception, or Epiphany, I should say. So, I mean, there's four or five adventure games that have been released in the last, 30 days. That have all made huge comebacks.
I think everything goes around in cycles. People get bored of first-person shooters, and they get bored of adventure games. It just all comes around again. You know, I can remember a while when, puzzle games weren't that popular. And now, of course, they're pretty popular again.
Yeah, I mean, you go on mobile, and it's puzzle left and right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's funny to see how all that works. So
yeah, I mean, adventure games are great as well because they're evolving. I mean, the stuff that Telltale have done is really sort of... move the quality bar, and they're kings of the game, really.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I'm just glad that younger developers and gamers now have the opportunity to really play a lot of what we had, in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, it's a real shame because a lot of the early ones, especially the LucasArts ones, it's hard to run them now. You have to run them on DOS emulators and things like that. It'd be really good if somebody. LucasArts or somebody got the rights for them and actually, re-released a lot of them, because there's a lot of work at the moment getting a lot of these back onto the iPad as well, which I think is a great medium for playing adventure games.
I agree completely. I mean, even it's the kind of thing where if you have 2 or 3 minutes to play real quick, you can just instantly resume the game, play from there, and put it away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is exactly how I played through the older Broken Sword games. They all were ported to iOS, and I cranked through them several months on a train ride.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. There are still new ones coming down. I think the Journey Down, I think it's called. I was playing that fairly recently. But there's still a lot of really, really good stuff coming out.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to what developers have to bring now.
Yeah.
So you were in the States working there, came back to the UK, and now you founded your own studio a couple of years ago, Total Monkery. Why don't you tell us a bit about what that process was like, both from a business perspective as well as development and coming up with ideas?
Well, basically, I got laid off again in the States, and if you don't
sounds like
come
the games industry, okay?
That's the games industry. Got laid off 3 times in a row, but that is games. So basically, you sort of have to get out of the country. So you know, I spent a couple of months driving around America, got my head together, decided I didn't want to work for another company. So what I did instead was, you actually have agents. I had a software agent, and they found me my first gigs in Britain. And I contracted for about 6 years before I started Total Monkery.
Okay.
And that was good because obviously I was working with lots and lots of different studios, you know, whether they were like, you know, big studios. I mean, I worked on a game for Rare, Microsoft, Sony, people like that. But then also I'd be working for smaller companies and indie studios. So I was sort of starting to get a feel for, you know, the way that the indie games works and, you know, sort of how they're self-publishing, etc. And then sort of got to the point in the end where didn't really want to contract anymore, so decided, well, let's just go for it. Let's start doing our own games. So we started up Total Monkery, and it's family business. It's me and my girlfriend's daughter and her boyfriend, and we now actually have our first non-family member, Fred, who I'm looking over at now. He's waving. And yeah, we all have pretty good complementary skills, so we felt it was the right time to be starting up. We've been through a few sort of phases. We're getting Total Monkery going. We started off doing a bit of client work, and then sort of we're working on another game which has been put on hold, and then we settled on this one because we felt this would be a good first release for us. But I've tried to start up games companies before, and it's hard. You know, you've got to basically make sure you've got enough money coming in, and you know, understand how to actually make a game from beginning to end. So I think it's taken me quite a while before I sort of realised that, you know, I can actually do it. And you know, it isn't just me. You know, there are 4 of us full time, 1 part time. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot on your shoulders, I'm sure, because like you said, you need to understand how to make a game from beginning to end, so you need to understand scope and scale, but all of a sudden you're wearing another hat and that you're managing a business and finances, and you know, you have other employees beneath you at this point, so or working alongside you. So now how do you handle, you know, like health insurance and making sure everyone gets paid, right? It's one thing if you go under, right?
Yeah.
You know, people can handle individuals, but all of a sudden when someone else is resting on your shoulders too, it becomes very difficult, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you just have to make sure that you've got the money around that everyone's taken care of, and you just have to look at where you're going to be, you know, not just 1 or 2 months down the line, but 6 months down the line, and just making sure that you're prepared. I think a lot of games companies have gone under because, you know, unforeseen things can happen, and you just don't have the money or the resources to carry on. But every one of us here has more than one hat. I mean, I tend to produce the game, and I'm the CTO, and I do the technical direction. But Will, our programmer, is the main guy that does Unity, and he'll also take care of he'll take care of the YouTubers. I'll do the Twitter feed, and the artists will do the blogging, and we're going to get Fred to do stuff as well. So we all try and do more than one job, which I think is a good way to run an indie studio now, rather than, you know, having people that literally just do one thing. Everyone sort of gets a feel for the industry as a whole.
Yeah, it's definitely a big dichotomy from AAA, where, like you said, people are complete specialists. Like, there's someone who handles just the lighting, you know, within the levels in a game, or someone who just I knew someone who worked at Rockstar, and they just handled the train schedules for Red Dead Redemption.
That
was their
crazy
job for years, just programming that stuff.
I mean, I knew some people at EA, and it would literally be the case that their job wasn't to make textures, it was to put them in the game. So it'd be, well, okay, there's there's a rock that somebody else built. These are some textures which somebody else built. My job is to put that texture on that rock. It's you know, it's, I think it's fine when you want to get into games, and some people like that, but I think after a while it gets a bit soul destroying.
Oh yeah, no, I'd imagine. That's why I don't think I could ever do the AAA thing either.
No, God, not anymore.
So why don't you tell us about what you're working on now?
We're working on a game called Magnets, which is the, let's call it a spiritual successor to a game I worked on in the 90s called Rat Attack, which I worked on at Pure Entertainment. We looked at trying to get the IP, but we couldn't. So what we thought instead was, let's take some of the fun that was in that game, because it had a quite interesting game mechanic, and bring it up to date. And what's ended up happening is it doesn't even resemble the game in any way whatsoever. We've just taken this game mechanic that the game that Rat Attack used and used it in our game, and you know, made it a lot better. But what we did want is, we wanted a game that, you know, kids can pick up and play. It's not violent, but yet it has a sort of a deep amount of gameplay going on. So there's a lot of skill in there if you really want to get in there, but you can just pick it up and play. So it's got, you know, multiplayer challenge, there's a story that runs through it, lots of character customizations. We started getting people to play it. We did a show last month which I think had about 70,000 odd people.
Holy cow. That was in the UK again, or Brighton?
Yeah, that was in Birmingham, which is in the north of Britain. So it's quite a big show. And at least 1,000 people played it. We got feedback forms from about 500. And overwhelmingly, people liked it. Because that was the first time we actually showed it to anyone. And what we found was, people really liked it, which is nice.
Yeah, you know, when I look at this immediately, it kind of has the feeling as though it's going to be like a twin-stick shooter. And I'm glad you said about like not having violence, because that's also what I noticed right away. You have these, you know, boxed creatures are coming after you, and it looks like you could have a twin-stick shooter, but then I saw quickly you have a net to kind of capture all these guys, lasso them up, and that is what really converts or destroys them, as opposed to, you know, running around and blasting everything, which is what we're so used to.
Yeah, I love twin-stick shooters. You know, I've played a lot of them. In fact, you know, There's a game coming called Android Assault Cactus.
I knew you were going to say that. Yes, I cannot wait for that game.
Fantastic looking game, and you know, got it on early access ages ago. But we didn't want to do another twin stick shooter. We wanted to do something a bit different. So we did choose this different sort of lassoing mechanic, and then rather than the idea of, you know, destroying or killing something, we have this idea of, you know, you have rogue robots, and what you have to do is collect them and recycle them. So, you know, we didn't particularly want to go for the whole sort of green message, etc., but it sort of fits in quite nicely with the story. That's sort of what we did, and it really works well with parents. Parents love the idea that, you know, it's not violent.
Right, so it's like all of the fun that we would have had with something like a violent twin stick shooter, but sans the violence. And instead of, like I said, killing or shooting, you're converting these characters.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. I mean, there was a game on the PlayStation 1 and I think 2 called Ape Escape. And that was great as well, because that sort of feels like a twin stick shooter. But again, you know, it just has that sort of net style mechanic, and, you know, you're rounding up all the monkeys.
Mm-hmm. And you guys are getting a great performance out of this, too. I mean, it looks like hundreds of particles on screen and hundreds of enemies coming after you, you know, kind of swarming.
Yeah, Unity's great. Unity, you know, a lot of people love Unity for the simple reason that you can just get something going really, really quickly, which is fantastic. But to really get the most out of it, you know, you've got to spend the time. So luckily, Will, our programmer, loves messing about with Unity and getting the most out of it as possible. So
I've been spending quite a bit of time doing lately too.
Yeah, we found out where the big sort of performance hogs are, and then what we've done is basically optimized around those, and now we're just at the point where we're just throwing stuff at it. I mean, the bots in the game are essentially cubes, but they're already, I think, at least between 200 and 300 polygons, and we're still throwing around hundreds of them with no real slowdown. And we specifically in the office don't run really fast computers, because then the problem is you get into the mindset of making a game that needs a lot of performance. So, that's right. You know, we have fairly average sorts of PCs, and even they're running the game really, really nicely. But we do actually later on want to get it onto, you know, the Vita and the 3DS. So yep. We've got a lot of plans in place to keep, you know, the performance up but still keep the quality.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you at all, especially for something like the 3DS. I think it'd be perfect. You know, I love that piece of hardware, but yep. They still have a pretty sparse selection of, like, indie games on there or games in general. But something like this would be perfect for it.
I mean, we've got Nintendo dev status, yep. And it's just really a case of when we're actually going to, you know, get some hardware. Because what I've always found is it's all about toys. As soon as you get a nice new bit of hardware, people want to play on it. So we'd like to do is get a bit further on with the game, and then we'll look at, you know, getting the hardware in and start getting the game going. But we'd frankly like to release it on everything. We'd like to see it on, you know, if you can play games on it, we'd like to release, you know, magnets on it, really.
Yeah, I mean, you're silly not to, and that's, like, really the largest selling point of using Unity is that it works just about everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, there are platforms that Unity supports that just aren't even viable anymore. I mean, the BlackBerry. BlackBerry. It's crazy. And, you know, occasionally we'll do a build to make sure it still works on the web player, and, you know, so far it still does. I mean, frankly, I'd just like to release it on everything. We won't release on mobile until we've released properly everywhere else.
Is there a particular reason why?
It worries me releasing on mobile. There's so much competition and visibility problems that I think there's a real problem for indie developers.
Yeah.
I think as Mike Little recently was talking about Thomas Was Alone, and he said he just wouldn't dream of releasing anything on mobile unless he had a name. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, Thomas Was Alone, I don't even think you would have seen it coming up unless, you know, it had, you know, such the exposure that it did on computer and console.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you know, it sold very, very well on PC, so it'd be really interesting to see how it would go over in the mobile space. But, you know, like you said, there is just so much competition, and it's very difficult to curate as well. You know, we love having these open marketplaces where developers can release their games on, and they're fantastic. But at the same time, you're then competing with everyone, and these stores need to find a way to specifically curate content for you know, for the individual developer. And I don't think any company has really figured out how to do that extremely well yet.
No, I think it's a problem with visibility. You know, we're sort of in an age now where the amount of people that can make games has just skyrocketed. And there's also a sort of a level of quality, you know, difference between a lot of them. So the problem is, you know, we're just being drowned in games, and it's very, very difficult. You know, Apple, I think, do try to do their best, you know, with everyone else to actually get visibility for everyone, but how can you actually do that when you've got thousands and thousands of games being released every single day? How do they know which ones are the ones that really should be supported?
Yeah, I mean, even if they know what, you know, your particular favorites are, like, I mean, I play a lot of twin stick shooters and a lot of adventure games, but I still haven't seen any store really curate anything to me. And even, like, Steam kind of runs into this problem too now, where they have so many games released every day that I can go on the front page and it doesn't mean anything to me. You know, I have to go there knowing what I'm looking for.
There's still games. I mean, I follow quite a few games. There's another game, I can't remember what it's called, but it's done by Megabot Games, and it's another twin stick shooter. It looks really good. But occasionally you come across these games, and then, you know, you're waiting for them to come out. But huge amounts of times things are just coming out and you've got no idea where they just came from. But apparently, you know, been being worked on for a year, sometimes 2 years. I just don't even know how you're going to get visibility. That's all part of the indie thing, though. It's basically, you know, anyone can make a game, but it's how are you going to sell that game? How are you going to get that game to be seen by the public?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like you're talking about visibility, I'm glad you brought up Android Assault Cactus before, because I had never heard of that game, and then all of a sudden on the show floor or some indie corner of GDC, I see this game, I'm thinking, whoa, I haven't seen a twin stick shooter that caught my attention in a while, and they've been working on this thing for, you know, over a year at this point. But you know, it's interesting to see how much these things can be hidden and how much it costs you to get them surfaced, right? Between the trade shows you go to, the marketing events, the PR, the podcasts, before you know it, all of your development time has gone out the window, and you're now just trying to promote your work the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, we did this show, the Gadget Show Live, where we had 1,000-odd players. And that basically meant that, you know, two of us wrote for a whole week, because it's a week-long show. And then the rest of the staff were there for, you know, half the week. So just in, you know, the amount of time and money it costs just to do that. Then you got the hotels on top of that. Luckily, the stand was free. But a lot of events you go to, you know, you have to pay for the stand as well. That can run into, you know, $1,000 possibly if it's like a four-day event. And it just mounts up. So the big thing with indies that we always look out for is, you know, any sort of events that are cheaper for us to go to. So this is why we need to enter so many competitions. But then, of course, it takes time to enter the competitions. I mean, there's no easy way to get your game out there, really. There's no one hard and fast rule of this is how you do it. I think every studio sort of does it differently.
Yeah, they're just kind of winging it, hoping for the best and seeing how it plays out.
Yeah, I think the worst thing is to stick your head in the sand and just make the game and then hope that, you know, once the game's made, it'll find an audience, because I think nowadays it's sort of showing that that won't happen. You've got to start finding that audience months in advance, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, we really only really started getting into Twitter in the last couple of months, and we've been blogging since day one, which is, I think, really helped, and now we're getting more followers. Yep. The blog's getting seen a lot more, but yeah, I mean, we've literally just started on the YouTubers.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you bring up a lot of good points there. So before I was doing this, I was, you know, writing about games for a while and Armless Octopus. And granted, we were like a very, very small site with a handful of people, and our idea was just to cover indie games on one platform. And even so, you know, our time was limited because there were so many games to cover. But we'd get, you know, developers shooting us an email the week or week after a release saying, "Hey, can you cover this?" And what I always tell developers is, like, establish relationships well before your game is released. This way, when it is time to actually have your game covered, you know the journalists, you know the marketing people, you know the other developers. If you kind of build in a bubble, nothing good will come out of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are getting YouTubers now preview builds. So we're about to release our first public demo, which, of course, is scary again. But it's fairly solid. But, you know, we've been giving YouTubers preview copies. We've been giving testers preview copies. We're actually based in the university campus, so we're going to be setting up, you know, people to play test it here. But, yeah, I mean, we realize that what journalists don't want is they want a story behind, you know, the game. And they don't want to be bugged too much. So if you're gonna say, you know, here's the demo, they're going to want to see that once, then they're going to want to see the game. So we try to be sensible in, you know, how often we bother people. And also, you know, every time we release something, we try and make sure there's a press release and, you know, we've got plenty of media, screenshots, etc. It's that's a full-time, you know, a full job in itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You raised a great point there before about the people part or the person element behind it. Mm-hmm. And Ben Kuchera, when he was at Penny Arcade, now he's at Polygon, he wrote, gave a great talk at a university. I wish I could find it again. But it was about finding that human element in that's you know, the journalist's story, because no one wants to read just a press release about a game. So the example he had cited was a developer like pitched a story to him, and he thought it was really, really boring about his games. Like, hey, okay. Then all of a sudden the guy comes out and says, well, you know, so I actually live on a farm, so I'm in a rural community, and because I don't want to wake up my wife at night with all my clicking, I have to do all the coding in a barn, you know, next door. Yeah. So I code in a barn, I have chickens around me, and I keep headphones on so I don't have to hear the chickens clucking. And he goes, that's it. Like, that is the selling point for the story.
Yeah.
Right? The game may not be fantastic, but that's the kind of story that people are going to write about and talk about and think, like, wow, that is a guy who codes in a barn surrounded by chickens.
Yeah, I mean, up until about a month ago, you know, our sort of Twitter front page just said, you know, Total Monkery started by me, and then didn't say anything about me. And then what we're sort of, you know, towed over time by, you know, people that were helping us with our PR, like Natalie, was that, you know, you need to get the story out there. So that's why we've actually, you know, our hook we've decided is, you know, we're a family business, so we play on that. And as well as that, you know, I've got a bit of experience in the games industry, so we play on that as well. I mean, it's hard. You got to find your hook. I know when I go through Twitter and I see people with their you know, their indie games on show, and you know, I want a link to see that game, and you know, I want to know a bit of the story. So
make it as easy as possible, you know, for both the journalist who's going to write the story, but as well as the, you know, the gamer who's going to go play it, right?
We have press kit on our sites, you know, press kit for the game, we've got press kit for the company. We try and make it as easy as possible, really.
Yep. And I'm sure you found, like, trying to promote and build a game at the same time is extremely difficult. And Vlambeer, run by Rami and Wilhelm Jansson.
They did a press kit,
Yes, they do press kit, and he gave a talk at GDC earlier this year, which was fantastic. And basically they explained how one of them, Rami, is always flying around promoting the game, working on flights, and at the other time their coworker is staying back at home, always coding, and does things like, you know, streaming on Twitch on Thursdays for a couple of hours. And they say that, you know, that's 3 or 4 hours. It's completely draining. It's a lot of work, but at the same time, the community then works with you. You're getting live feedback, but they see all of your mistakes along the way. So it's really like it's a two-way street. It's like that dialogue where you're constantly going back and forth, and people are aware of what's happening.
Yeah, we were going to put Twitch in last month, and then we sort of decided post-demo we're going to get Twitch in and actually use it for the whole, you know, we want it for everything, really. We want it, one, we want to see how people are playing the game. We want to get feedback about how they're playing. But also, you know, we do sort of, the way that we tend to run sort of fairly loose here. We don't have absolutely set schedules. So we do come up with, you know, crazy little ideas, which we might put in the game and then get saved out. So, you know, streaming that, I think, would be a lot of fun. So that's something we definitely be looking into.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's something that takes work again, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it used to be that Fridays here were blog day, which used to take up about half the day. And the problem is, we've just got to a point that we've got so much to do that we haven't actually blogged now for a couple of weeks. It's just that sort of problem. Sometimes you've got lots of time to do certain things. Sometimes you haven't. At the moment, we've got to get the demo out. So that's taking precedent, really.
Right. It's like, you know, time is a finite resource, and you have to decide how you're best going to spend it.
I mean, it's... I saw this quite a lot when I was working at big studios, that, you know, a lot of them would think, you know, if you bring in an extra 10 people and there are 20 people working on the game, that, you know, it will take, you know, a third less time.
Ah, yes, not, the mythical man month, right?
Not the case. And it's not the case of any size company, really. I mean, we're looking at getting some interns here to help out on some of the PR, etc. But we realize that, you know, they'll need to be looked over and make sure they're doing a good job, etc.
Exactly.
So it's going to take up time as well, and you just have to basically strike a happy balance between, you know, what you want to do, really.
Yeah, it's an investment in anything else, you know, just having a new person on board. You've got to teach them your ways, what's right, what's wrong, how you want to be seen. But in terms of blogging, what I've discovered works really well for a lot of developers is when they get very specific about a particular thing they have in the game. So, for example, someone will say, like, here are 50 best practices for working with Unity. And who better to explain it than a studio that's making a game with Unity? So there might be things like brief code snippets or, you know, a class that you're exposing and explaining, like, why it works or how you work as a team. And then from there, it really starts to grow, I hate this word, but virally. Because, you know, not only are you appealing to game players, but also now developers who are using those same tools who are going around sharing, like, hey, here's what worked for a studio of 5 people. Maybe this will work for us as well.
Yeah, and Anya, our blogger and copywriter, who's also does all the art, well, not all the art since we got Fred. But yeah, basically, she's been bugging me since the beginning of the year to start doing some technical, you know, blogging, which I haven't done, but I think it's something that I really do need to get into, because the sort of things that I find out are, the great thing about working in games for 20 years is I've picked up little tricks and, you know, little tricks which I'm surprised that a lot of people don't know. So I think I really do need to start blogging about them as well. So yeah, I think you're completely right. I mean, it's just a way to get people engaged with you, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right about those small tips and tricks. I mean, you have a lot of experience over, you know, novice developers who are coming in, and it's one of those things where it happens so frequently or commonly with you that you don't even think that it doesn't really seem like anything because you're so used to it.
Yeah, because I mean, I lecture as well at the local university, and I've been sort of teaching them bits and pieces. So things like, you know, in Unity, one of the big things you have to do is object pooling. So
Right.
I made a whole, you know, let's think. There were two lessons just on the theory behind object pooling and then actually how to do it.
Perfect. And I'm glad you bring that up because so often I'll see, you know, beginner tutorials where they just don't cover that at all. And I get, like, you know, beginner level things, but
yeah.
That's one of the first, I want to say, like, bottlenecks people run into when making a game is all of a sudden, hey, I have 100 bullets on screen. I'm getting 5 frames a second. Yeah. What's going on?
I jokingly did a post on Twitter saying, you know, day one, you know, start writing Unity game. Day two, write an object pooler. I mean, it's the biggest thing you have to do because it's where all your time goes, really.
That was the first thing I did for this game. Yeah.
Yeah, that and just completely random things like, I'll just attach a load of things to this game object and then forget about them, and then you don't realize just how much time they're taking up.
Definitely.
But object pooling, we've had in for months. I mean, it was quite an early thing that we put in.
Yeah, and again, like, that's perfect thing to cover too, because when I was learning pooling, they don't teach this in schools. Only a handful of developers even talk about it. And then, you know, I started writing about exactly that because I figured, you know what, I'm a pretty clever guy. If I run into this issue, someone else must have run into this at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, who better to talk about it than you?
I did a whole lecture about lists and arrays, which is basically a lot of people don't understand what goes on behind the scenes when you actually start resizing arrays and how much of a performance hit it can be.
Yeah.
I really need to start blogging about this.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, small things. Or, you know, JavaScript developers get used to only using arrays because that's all that's available to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you go back to using something like C#, which is, you know, I went back to Unity, same issue. I was like, wait, what? Oh, you don't want to use an array here. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many little caveats to programming in C#. So it's fantastic, you know, language. It allows you to do so much really quickly, but it can really hit you if you start to do things slightly wrong.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So, speaking of programming, getting all this stuff out, where are you guys aiming at the moment? I know that you're trying to avoid mobile for at least the first few months, but other than that, you're shooting for which platforms?
We will be going for the classic Unity platforms, which will be Mac, Linux, and PC in September. We have Nintendo approval. We are also looking to get approval at the other console giants. And that is ongoing. So what we're hoping is, you know, if somebody has a preference, we'll try and get it on console first. Else, you know, get the computers out of the way in September. Then we'll do a console version. And we've got a lot of DLC planned. We've even built it into the story that we can actually keep on releasing DLC. So we want the game to last. We want to have a lot in there. So, you know, a year from now, we could still be releasing, you know, slightly different versions of the game on different platforms with different amounts of DLC, things like that. Once we have a name, once people actually know what the game is, then we'll probably release on mobile. We did have a test version run on iPad a while ago. It was fun enough, but I think what we'd like to do is, you know, do it properly, do it so it actually feels right for the iPad rather than having, you know, lots of confusing buttons which your fingers keep on slipping off.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And, you know, in today's market, I think DLC is almost essential for most games because it gives you that long tail, which then also gets more people just generally aware of your game in addition to that.
Yeah, I mean, we plan on giving some DLC away for free. So, you know, if you sign up for the game early, we'll give you certain bits for free, which you then, you know, nobody else can get. We'll give some away for free during the games. You'll earn some, and then some you'll buy, you know. We want to get onto, you know, PS Plus if we get onto Sony. So, again, you know, you make some money out of DLC, you know, on top of the subscription. There's just lots and lots of ways to, you know, just earn a bit of money because that's what it's all about with indie. You know, you've got to earn bits of money here and there, and that just allows you to carry on.
All right, so how do you keep the lights on at the end of the day? And this is one way of doing that.
Yeah.
But I think that DLC kind of earned a bad reputation early on. You know, largely because it was really AAA that was doing it at first, you know, especially on the last generation of consoles.
Yeah.
And then people kind of saw it as, well, they're just removing content and just making me pay for it later on. When I don't doubt that has happened at some point. But reality's situation is that game development costs have gone up quite a bit. I mean, they've gone down in many cases too, but like you said, visibility is a large issue. So I think for indies, this is a great way to start planning out the long tail on your game.
Yeah, and I think the main difference at indies is indies, you know, I think with the big companies, you know, the people that are making the game aren't the ones that are making the decisions about what sort of content's going in the game, because, you know, it's handled further up the chain. With indies, you know, we choose, you know, what we want to do, and what we want to do is give some stuff away for free. You know, we value the people that buy our games, and we want to give something back. So, you know, in the end, if you give half your DLC away, but the other half is paid for, people are probably going to, you know, buy stuff if they know they're also going to get some stuff for free. You know, you're basically, you know, you're building your community, basically. And I don't think a lot of the big companies do that. They just want to be paid.
Yeah, you're right. There is no handbook for making games right now, as much as I wish there was. You know, because even with, you know, your status in the industry as a veteran, I'm sure you've seen, like, how it's changed and molded, you know, over the years, and how completely different it is now. So these are things even the biggest companies are learning.
It's strange, because it's the way that things are now is quite a lot like it was in the 80s. I mean, I had my first computer when I was sort of 10, 11, and, you know, a lot of games where people were making games in their bedrooms, and then they were selling them directly to the shops. So they were even basically buying loads of blank cassettes, recording the game, you know, onto the cassette, and then selling it to the shop. So I mean,
it's putting like a plastic baggie with like a printout and the instruction manual.
Yeah, I mean, I know of people that have been making games since about, you know, 82, 83, and that's what they were doing. And then what happened was, you know, the publishers started coming in, realizing that there was money to be made. But you know, in the 80s, practically everybody was an indie. Then it started going to the big companies in the late 80s, you know, with the rise of EA, etc., and Psygnosis. And now it's sort of, I'm not going to say gone full circle, because, you know, the AAA market is absolutely huge, but indie's pretty big now, or I don't even know what you would call them, you know, the big indie studios, you know,
like non-publisher attached studios. I mean, I don't know.
There are lots of indie studios that have, you know, 100, 200 people, so do you call those indie? Or, you know, there needs to be sort of different names for this stuff nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, because if you look at, you could say Valve is indie, you know, largely because they don't listen to any publisher. They're a private company. Granted, they have hundreds of employees, right, and probably make more money than most companies out there. But they're, by traditional definition, indie, I believe.
Well, LucasArts, LucasArts when I was working for them, didn't release their own games. They were released by Activision. So I suppose you could essentially say that, you know, LucasArts were an indie as well, and there were, oh god, must have been 500 plus people when I was there.
Oh man, yeah, it's wild to see like how studio sizes can change over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So September, looking for a release of your game, and then after that, are you looking to go back to your original idea that you were working on previously, or you want to continue, kind of split your team in half and go back to Ilaria? Or Ilara, I should say.
Well, we have Ilaria, which is a game that I was working on part-time, which is what we actually started the company to do. And then what we sort of realized was that the game that we got going, we had much better plans for it. You know, it has such a great little story behind it and such a great idea behind how the game mechanic works that we didn't want to sell it short. So it's gone from being a 2D sprite-based game to a game that uses, you know, lots of Unity tricks, which, you know, we haven't quite got working yet, but, you know, we will do. And, you know, it has a community system built in so that you can make your own levels, etc. So it's one of those things where it needs a bit of investment to actually do well. So I think what we're going to be doing is trying to see if we can get some investment to get that game going. But we also, for a while, we went through this stage where we just kept on coming up with lots of game ideas and getting little prototypes together. So we've got quite a few things that we could, you know, do next. So I think what's probably going to end up happening is over the coming months, you know, Magnets will be just about ready to come out. And we'll just start formulating plans based around, you know, how much money is in the bank and who we've been talking to and things like that, really. I mean, we had some interest in some of the other games. It's just a case to see, you know, what if, really.
Yeah, and hard to nail down which one you actually want to do at that point.
Absolutely. I think if you've got plenty of money in the bank, you know, you can work out what you're going to be doing 6 months down the line. But, you know, a lot of the cases for indie, you're you're chasing money, you're chasing funding, so you sort of have to go with the flow, and it's just working out how, you know, best to work with that, really.
Yep. Okay, so now we're bringing things to a close here. Mm-hmm. We play the same question and answer game that I give to all developers every time. So I'm going to ask you a question that the previous developer who was on had asked, and then I'm going to ask that you have a question of your own for whoever comes in the show next.
Okay.
So last episode, PHL Collective, a small startup right here in Philly, had asked, why did play to win become a thing? So I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on play to win. You know, we talked about DLC before, but I think pay to play and pay to win are very different things.
I think the pay to win thing, it's a contentious subject. It's
is that greedy publishers or what?
I think with games, as soon as something becomes possible to do, it's going to happen. So you know, as soon as mobile came in, we got the race to the bottom, which is now why we have games being released for free and freemium. Right. I just think it's another way for companies to make money, and I have to say, it leaves a bit of taste in your mouth, doesn't it? I mean,
definitely, absolutely.
The fact that, you know, I think if it's done badly, it's just awful. Because obviously, someone who's actually not as good at a game can do better than someone with skill. If it's done well, and you're literally talking that it means that someone who's not as good can get back into the game more quickly, then I don't think that's a bad thing. So you have some games where, you know, they have like cooldown periods for fighting games, you know, where they have to heal. So I think if you're paying to aid that, that's not awful. If you're paying, say, to add extra moves to a fighting game, I think that's utterly wrong. It's got to be a level playing field, really. I mean, we have certain games. I mean, Iliara, one of our games, we decided that, you know, as you add skills to the character, it would be unfair if you were playing multiplayer and somebody had some skills and somebody else didn't. So greedy publishers, I suppose it is a little bit, really, but it's tricky to make money. You've got to find different ways to make money, and that's just one of the ways. So you know, it's not going to go away the same way that freemium's not going to go away. You know, they're all here to stay. We just need to sort of, you know, knuckle down and get on with it, really.
Or I guess it helps to support the games that do it correctly.
I think it's the same with freemium. Certain freemium games work really well. You know, they're engaging, you know, they don't have a pay barrier, and you can play them and have fun. Certain games do it incredibly badly. I'm thinking of a certain EA game that did it so badly that I downloaded the game, and within 10 minutes I deleted it. And, you know, the original PC version was a fantastic game, and they just turned it into something awful. But I think if things are done right, if any of these sort of micropayment systems are done correctly, they can actually aid the game. I think it's when they're done wrong that people fixate upon, you know, the bad examples, and then they just see that as, you know, an excuse for saying, oh, this is bad. But when it's done right, people don't tend to go, well, actually, that's really good, so maybe this isn't such a bad thing.
Right. We can't generalize and say, you know, all free-to-play is bad because, you know, X, Y, and Z has done it poorly.
Yeah, I've not personally, but I've paid for my girlfriend to have extra moves on Candy Crush. You know, it was something that, you know, wasn't too bad, and frankly, I got a lot of gameplay out of it, so didn't mind actually, you know, handing over a bit of cash.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, I think any of these sorts of things, if they're done well, great. If they're not done well, I think people just fixate upon them and use it as an example of why all of that is bad, etc.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, the real instance that stood out in my mind, not really instance, but I went to go play Mega Man X when they ported that to iOS.
Yeah.
And they had things like, you know, get more weapons or get more health, and you had to pay for it. And I was like, no, this was a cheat code 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, nah, you're paying me for a cheat, or I have to pay you for a cheat code.
I mean, you can sort of understand that some people don't some people don't have the time to invest in unlocking. So when it comes down to that, I think absolutely you should be able to find, you know, you should be able to have a better car, better weapons. That's not a problem. Yep. It's when it comes into the multiplayer domain that, you know, you hit a problem, really. Contra, I downloaded Contra on iOS, and it was just like, oh, you've died, and now you've got to wait 20 minutes to play the next game. At least I think it was Contra. But it was just, it's done so, so badly that I just deleted the game and didn't want to play it again.
I don't blame it. Yeah, and Contra's a classic, too.
It is especially a classic. But then again, I've got it on the SNES, so I'll just play it on the SNES.
Yeah. All right, so now you've wrapped that up. Do you have a question for the next developer who comes on board?
Yeah. So, at the moment, there's been lots of talk about how the indie bubble is about to burst. Whether you believe it's about to burst or not, or whether you actually do believe there's an indie bubble at all, my question is, how do you see the indie scene 5 years from now?
I'd be curious to see what the next person has to say about that, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, 5 years ago, there really wasn't an indie scene, so it is interesting to see how it will look 5 years out.
Yeah, it's... I don't even know. I mean, I've seen lots of different states of the gaming industry, and, you know, everyone's been different, really, and it's... I think a lot of people will tell you that they know how things are going to go, but I'd just be interested to see what people actually think is, you know, going to change, or is it going to be very similar to the way it is now, or is it going to be, you know, a lot more of companies like EA or Activision splintering off small companies, which I remember happening in the 90s. I'd be interested to see what other people think.
Yeah, I mean, look at arcades, right? Who would have thought those things would have died as quickly as they did?
I know, it's awful. I still love arcades.
You and I both. Well, thank you very much, Richard, for joining us this weekend.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
So where can we find you? What is your Twitter handle, or what's the page to go find Total Monkery?
Well, luckily, the easy thing is if you just Google Total Monkery, the first sites that come up will be ours. So basically on Facebook, it's Facebook.com/Total Monkery. Twitter is Total Monkery. And we've also got an IndieDB page and all that sorts of stuff. So yeah, so essentially, if you just go through any one of our portals, we link everything up.
All right, first hit on Google. That's what I like to hear. Sounds like someone's an SEO master over there.
That's an important thing. Make sure you come number one on Google.
Yes. Yeah. All right, thank you again for joining us, and hopefully we'll have you on afterwards and follow up and see how the game is done with development.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. Cool. We'll be right back.